Hello, I'm Ryan Beasy, and this is the Westminster Standard Podcast. Martin Luther is reported to have said, "The Christian cobbler does his duty not by putting little crosses on the shoes, but by making good shoes." Now, almost all scholars agree Martin Luther never actually said that, but it nonetheless illustrates a biblical principle that reemerged in the Reformation, the Christian doctrine of vocation. Namely, that all believers are called to serve God, not just in the church, but in their various employments and what we might call secular jobs, but often are called vocations. And that extends even to lawyers. In fact, God has used lawyers often within the kingdom. Both Martin Luther and John Calvin were trained in law before they were called to gospel ministry. Likewise, many of the founding fathers of the PCA were lawyers. Our Book of Church Order was written in large part by two godly lawyers, Bob Canada and Jack Williamson. Godly Christian jurists bring unique gifts and concerns to the church. Their study of language often gives them special insights into the biblical text for the encouragement of God's people. Their ability to understand process and language helps the church operate decently and in order to faithfully shepherd the flock of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Often pastors and others can get caught up in false dichotomies, and it's frequently the lawyers who help us see through to a right balance, that those things that we thought were either or are actually a both and. And so lawyers bring valuable insights and wisdom to serve the church in applying our standards and to remain faithful to the truth. And so I am joined today by one such Christian lawyer whom God has deployed for his service in the kingdom, ruling elder Matt Fender. Welcome. Thanks for joining.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So Matt, how did you come to the Reformed faith and the Presbyterian Church in America in particular?
Some might find some irony in how this occurred, but I originally came to faith in a Southern Baptist church, was immersion baptized at the age of 12. So I'm covered, even if we're wrong about infant baptism, I'm covered. But then really had a fairly shallow understanding, didn't have access to any good teaching. And I always say, if somebody had given me a copy of the Westminster Confession when I was about 18, my life would have been a lot easier. Would have given me the actual answers to some hard questions. But I sort of, continued on that path. And then in 1998, when I guess I was 24, I moved to New York City for a job. And a friend there invited me to church. And that church was Redeemer Pres. And I heard Tim Keller preach. And at the time, I thought it was the best preaching I'd ever heard. I mean, not to take anything away from his excellent preaching, but I had just never heard any good preaching before. So therefore, it seemed particularly spectacular. And I came to Reformed conviction while there at Redeemer in 1998. And so I guess I realized today and this year in the 50th anniversary of the PCA that I have been in the PCA for 25 years. Mm. So half of the existence of the PCA.
Wow. And so how are you serving the PCA now? You're ruling elder at All Saints in Richmond. How else are you serving?
Well, I like to think that my service at All Saints is my primary, way of serving the church and shepherding our congregation and teaching, occasionally preaching and helping govern the congregation, the church there. I am very active in our presbytery. I've served on various committees. I was moderator 1 year. Most significantly, probably for this podcast, I prosecuted this year, last year and this year, a pastoral abuse case on behalf of the presbytery. And that ended up being a fairly big lift. We had a very protracted trial. It was five long trial days, probably 50 hours of testimony. I think we had 19 witnesses, very extensive transcript. And so that was sort of my latest thing for the presbytery. And of course, at the General Assembly level, I've served on the Overtures Committee a number of times, been elected to serve this coming year. I've been on some other committees of commissioners. I was on RPR this year. I've also sit on the Committee for Constitutional Business. This will be my third year coming up doing that. I think that's about it.
That's all? And you're hosting General Assembly next year, is that right?
We are. I'm not personally on the host committee.
We're not meeting at your house.
Yeah. Well, my wife is actually running all the women's and children's programs. She's chairing this up.
Wonderful.
For that. So our family is going to certainly be all in. We told the kids they can't go to Ridgehaven that week because they've got to help at General Assembly.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. So there recently was an overture that was seeking to limit how Christians who are lawyers participate in the church courts, and to admit atheists to the church courts. Thankfully, both of those efforts failed. But how do you see lawyers as bringing a special giftedness to the church and as church officers or the church courts in particular?
Well, so I guess first is, do I see lawyers as bringing a special giftedness to the church? And I wrote an article on this that was published on Presbyterian Polity back in the spring when this overture was coming up. And I don't know that I have much new to say on it, but I'll try to summarize. I mean, first and foremost, right? I mean, to the extent I or any other lawyer has standing in the church courts, it's not because I'm a civil lawyer, right? It's because I'm an elder, right, who has standing in the church courts by virtue of our polity.
Yes.
And the fact that I am licensed to practice law, in my case, in two states, doesn't matter one way or the other, right? I could have a law license or not have a law license. I don't think it has anything to do with the church.
Yes.
So that was part of my objection to that overture, was that it sought to classify elders based upon their civil vocations, which I think is just fundamentally, you know, in glaring conflict with our polity.
Yeah.
But what is true is that people who become lawyers and people who practice law tend to develop a certain skill set, a certain way of thinking, in a very, like, you know, linear, analytical kind of way. We think a lot about rules and putting things in buckets and sort of sorting them out and thinking about elements and that kind of training and practice. And I've been practicing law for 15 years, kind of. And before that, I did software and wrote code. So you put all that together, and I guess that makes me hyperlinear. But it just trains you to be hopefully of some use when we have these difficult procedural things, and particularly when we're dealing with cases of process, right? Whether it's a complaint or whether it's an actual case of process where charges have been brought and maybe there's a trial or an appeal, you know, we're essentially doing ecclesiastical law, and so. I always kind of look at it like, if you needed your house painted, you'd probably, you know, and you wanted somebody from the church to help, you probably call the guy who knows how to paint. And similarly here, when we have, you know, judicial stuff to do, it always strikes me as sort of obvious that you'd want to call up some guys that maybe, you know, knew something about that or had some experience. I mean, for example, when we're doing a trial, eliciting evidence and doing cross-examination are skills, right? I'm sure everybody who's listening to this, you know, has watched a trial on TV or maybe has some experience going to court. Well, I mean, they dramatize it for TV, but at the end of the day, you got to be able to stand there and ask the questions. You know, you got to be able to cross-examine a witness, do a direct examination. There's a difference. There's different ways you ask the questions. You got to know how to handle exhibits. And, you know, these are just skills you have. So if I have those skills, I'm happy to use them to help serve the church. There's been some grumbling, I think, that I've sort of heard throughout the denomination of people that are sort of dissatisfied with this. And I think it's a small minority that think, gosh, we should dumb the process down because it's too hard. Mm. And ultimately, what I'd say to that is, you know, the way we conduct trials in the civil sphere and to the extent that crosses over into the church sphere, that's been developed over a long period of time. I mean, the common law that we inherited in this country is 1,000 years old, right? And it reflects 1,000 years of accumulated wisdom over how to do this sort of stuff. For example, the rule against hearsay was famously created after Sir Walter Raleigh was convicted based upon hearsay testimony. And that's when they decided maybe it'd be a good idea to have a rule against hearsay, you know. Wow. And so this sort of stuff develops over time. So we're not bound, of course, by the edicts of the common law and how we conduct proceedings within the PCA. But we're wise to take those principles into account of fairness and how to present evidence, because there is a lot of wisdom embodied in them, at least in my view. And I've talked long enough, I'll stop.
No, I think that's very important that, you know, our process should be, it should be understandable. It should be so easy that it's accessible, but it shouldn't be so simplistic. That there's no distinction between different types of evidence. What is allowed as evidence? What constitutes, as the Jonesboro case illustrates, what constitutes an indictment and a charge and specifications? So you alluded to common law, which, you know, of course, dates back to 1066 at least. What are some of the differences, though, between the way a church court operates in matters of discipline versus a criminal court? Are there these overlapping principles? You've touched on some of them, but what are some ways that it would be very different from, say, the county court to Presbytery or even SJC?
Well, at some level, I mean, it's not always as different as you might think, but certainly when we're doing trials, it's less formal.
Yeah.
You know, trials are in civil court, it varies depending on what court you're in. You know, if you're in federal court in New York City, that's going to look a little different than if you're in the circuit court of, you know, Podunk, Georgia, right? It's just in terms of the level of formality, yes. Although the basic principles are still there. But, you know, I have done in my career a fair amount of arbitration practice. And arbitration, for anyone who doesn't know, is sort of like a private trial. Mm-hmm. So many contracts, and if you have a cell phone or you attend a utility bill, you have certainly agreed to arbitration in those contracts. You can in your contract say, hey, if we have a dispute under this contract, we promise that we're not going to go to court. Instead, we will resolve it by arbitration. And there's private organizations that administer arbitrations for a fee, and that's what they do. The most famous is the American Arbitration Association, also known as the AAA. And so if you and I have a dispute and we've had an arbitration clause in our contract and you sue me, then I can go to court and wave that contract around and say, oh, no, you have promised not to sue me and you may not sue me. And then the court will then stay the case pending the outcome of the arbitration. They'll say, no, you guys go arbitrate. Hmm. And we'll then get ourselves one or maybe three RENA judges who will then convene in a conference room somewhere, and we will have a trial in front of these arbitrators, right? And these are usually retired judges or their lawyers who just agreed to do this. And we will have something like a trial, and they'll then make a decision. That decision is binding, and whoever wins can then carry the decision back to the court and say, here's the decision, and the court will then enter judgment on that decision, and that's the outcome, right? So when you do arbitration, I think that our church trials are kind of analogous to that, in that they're kind of like in somewhat more informal trials. You know, you find yourself in a church fellowship hall or in a conference room or somewhere doing something that looks like a trial, but without all of the trappings. You know, there's no jury. You don't have a bailiff. Usually the rules of evidence are significantly more informal. You know, I mean, they're still there. The principles are still there, but yes. A lot of times the judges will maybe let stuff in that wouldn't strictly come in court, because they can sort of weigh it themselves and decide, you know, what it's worth, that kind of thing. So I think our church process, at least at the trial level, looks to me a lot like arbitration. And I think that's right. That's probably what it should look like. We wouldn't want it to be as formal as say federal court.
That's a good analogy. And so in the, we recently looked at the Judicial Commission's ruling in Harrell versus Covenant Presbytery. I'm told at the SJC hearing, two of the lawyers on the panel, I think one of whom is in your presbytery, really took the lead at querying, I don't know if that's the right verb, but questioning the case that the presbytery was bringing. Do you have any particular reflections on that case as an elder who happens to also be a lawyer?
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't know anything about it. You mentioned for my presbytery, ruling elder Dan Carroll, who's a dear friend, has been, you know, a great encouragement to me as I have gotten more and more involved in the church. I have a lot of respect for Dan, and also, you know, ruling elder Jim Eggert wrote the opinion. I think very highly of Jim as well. I didn't know anything about that case until I read the SJC report this year. Right, it was getting ready for General Assembly, so I cracked it open and read it, and also on CCB we review the minutes of the SJC, so I had access to the minutes as well. But I read the decision and. Honestly, I was shocked. I mean, I couldn't believe that this had gone as far as it had. The whole thing struck me as just an incredible abuse of process in terms of what had gone on below. I mean, the actions of the provisional session were just completely out of bounds, at least in my view, in terms of any kind of due process, right? And I was thrilled to see that the SJC, you know, seems to have unanimously done the right thing and reversed it. And kind of the only question I had left was, gosh, did anybody think about, you know, bringing process against the session member to the session who did this? And it sounds like that's maybe water under the bridge at this point. But yeah, that was my initial response, was just, you know, you can't do this. You can't issue an indictment against somebody without specifications, without telling them what they're accused of.
Right.
That's one of those fundamental principles that we were talking about earlier, you know, sort of enshrined in our civil law. And it's in the BCO. It's not like it's, you know, we're stretching here. I mean, there's a reason. You can't expect a man to defend himself if you don't tell him what he's accused of. And also this idea that there was some kind of like burden shifting almost, like, you know, well, no, you have to prove you're innocent. No, that's not how it works, right? And the thing that keeps coming to mind to me is if our Lord had the right to stand silent before the Sanhedrin, then an accused before the first court certainly has the same.
Yes. Wow. Yeah. I didn't think about that analogy, but yes, absolutely. You brought up a couple of things I want to come back to. You used the word abuse of process, which, of course, the General Assembly or the Judicial Commission also used that word abused. Failure to include the specificity so obvious in the indictments is unjustifiable. We find that the broad indictments were abused to the prejudice of the accused, who were not adequately informed of the charges against them. That word, that verb, abuse, is of course a loaded word in our historical moment. Could you comment on what you think? I know obviously you don't have access to their mind, but what when a jurist says abused, that brings with it a lot of baggage, at least outside of a court. Does it have that sort of connotation within a court?
No, I don't think okay. so. Right. And I've dealt, you know, pastorally with this a little bit in our, yes. our church and in other contexts. And, you know, I think, frankly, you know, you see that you have this sort of Twitter mob that's always going on yes. about abuse, yes. too. And I think there's some deliberate ambiguity in how that word is sometimes used.
Right. Right.
That it's kind of like, at one level, it sort of evokes the idea of somebody beating somebody up or committing some kind of sexual sin.
Right.
But then it gets sort of blurred into meaning these kind of like undefined things, meaning you said mean things to me. And so I find it to be fairly unhelpful in a lot of context.
Right.
When someone says, oh, well, you know, I'm accusing you of abuse. Well, what does that mean? That means nothing to me. So yes. you're going to have to be more specific if you're going to make that accusation against someone. Tell me what, you know, he or she did, you know, did, said, and what time and who was there. And, you know, you got to be specific. And right. so I find it to be unhelpful in a lot of contexts, but specifically in the legal context, when using this kind of technical sense, we talk about like an abuse of process.
Right.
It means just what it says. It means you've taken the legal process, in this case, the church legal process, and used it in a manner so as to work injustice. If I had to give a thumbnail definition, I guess what I would say.
So to use it to work injustice, and again, I think the decision uses that same idea. The failure to include specificity is unfair to an accused and violates basic principles of process as required by our standards. So unfair, is that a synonym for unjust?
Maybe. Fairness to me seems to speak more to process, and justice seems to speak more to substantive outcome.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Now, a lack of substantive process certainly can produce an unjust outcome. And you might argue, I would probably argue, maybe an injustice in and of itself. Mm. Right. I mean, if you think about what we do in the civil courts, if you ever watch Law and Order, you know, and that show did a good job of demonstrating that sometimes we turn people loose and we know they're guilty. We just can't prove it, or the evidence wasn't handled right, or the Fourth Amendment is going to turn them loose because, you know, they had that right to search and seizure that was violated. You know, you got the cocaine that was in their house, but ultimately the police, you know, didn't have a warrant, and therefore that evidence doesn't come in, and therefore they're going to be set free. You know, so there is something to be said for the importance of process. A lot to be said.
Yes. Yes. You know, and you mentioned, you know, process against session members. I don't think that would be possible, because I was trying to explain this to my wife, and maybe I've explained it wrong. You could probably explain it better, but, you know, no member of session actually acted in this. It was the court of the Lord Jesus Christ that acted. So you can't really say that Elder so-and-so did anything, or is that explanation inaccurate?
You know, that's a good question, Ryan. I don't know that I have a good answer to it. So I was appointed this year by the officers of RPR to prosecute the citation against Metro New York Presbytery that was brought at this last General Assembly.
Yes.
And That's we've now argued that case before the full SJC and are awaiting a decision. But one of the things that sort of came up as we were prepping for it, because we had to decide what relief to ask for, and what we asked for was that the presbytery be directed to institute process against both a particular teaching elder and against a session. And that's because I don't think a presbytery can't institute process against a ruling elder absent some very unusual circumstances.
Yeah.
Right. Because they don't have original jurisdiction over. Right. I guess if two other churches in the same presbytery petition the presbytery, we have this sort of language where that could happen. But in the ordinary course, there is no such jurisdiction. Right. And so here we had a provisional session. I couldn't even tell you everybody who was on it. But I guess in theory, the TE members would be subject to original jurisdiction in the presbytery. The RE members in whatever church they're a member of.
Right.
But I don't know the answer to, can a member of a session be individually subject to process for voting for something?
Yeah. And I don't know that I just think that would set a dangerous precedent that, if I can be brought up on charges for my vote. Here we have a case that thankfully sets good precedents in the end, although along the way, some egregious lessons learned, perhaps. What are some of the most urgent lessons in that vein that you think the PCA can learn from this decision, this whole process?
Well, I mean, I guess first and foremost, what this looked like to me was substantively, and again, I do not know anything about the underlying facts other than what's in the SJC decision and a couple of briefs that I read. So I don't want to speak ill of anybody, violate the Ninth Commandment, anything like that.
No, of course not.
But it certainly, and I'll speak generally. I have a friend who told me once that, who I will not name, that a certain presbytery he thought had become a pastor's union. And I think there can be a tendency sometimes for it to be just that, for presbyteries, guys in presbyteries, to look out for each other in a sense that, gosh, after all, these other teaching elders, my brothers, this is their job. If you take any action against them, a guy might lose his job. That'd be bad. It's his career. And you ruling elder guys, you just don't really understand because, for you, this is just a hobby. And there's a certain default tendency to protect one another. Mm-hmm. That I have observed from time to time, and I think is out there. And I think, you can see a guy plants a church, labors diligently for 4 years, and then the idea that the congregation is pushing back on him being installed as the permanent pastor, you guys don't understand why there's some objection to that, right? But what this shows you is the reason we have process, the reason we have very strict rules laid out in the BCO, is it provides a way for us to resolve conflict.
Yeah.
Right. If we follow the rules, then we can resolve the conflict. Right.
Impersonally, without getting in each other's faces, we can just address the moderator.
Yeah, but I mean, it's when things are hard that's when we need it the most. Right.
Absolutely.
When we're all getting along, it's not as big a deal. But here, I mean, I don't even know really what to say. I mean, these indictments were just fatally flawed. The whole idea of bringing process against these people because they disagreed with the session. I mean, you're allowed to disagree with the session, particularly when here, it's a sphere of power that's not the session's power, right? I mean, our polity divides church power amongst basically four different groups, right? We've got three courts of the church, and then we've got the congregation. And here you have a role which is very clearly delineated and assigned to the congregation. You got members of the congregation who are being told they aren't allowed to deliberate, they aren't allowed to talk, they aren't allowed to, they just have to go along whatever the session says. I mean, that's just clear error. And then to compound that by instituting process against them and wrongfully convicting them based upon deficient indictments, I don't know what to say about it. I mean, it's just, as you've rightly recognized, it's just outside the pale. And then the presbytery, affirms it. I don't know. I don't think this is something that we need to write into the book of church order. We just need to follow the book of church order in this case.
Right. Yeah. As that was part of my underlying thesis as I approached this, is that our system works. It may take a while, but the problems we get into is when we don't follow it.
No, that's certainly right.
And, we've heard that argument for a number of issues. One modification to our polity that might be considered is allowing any communing member of the PCA to represent people before any court of the PCA. You know, I wonder what would have happened, or if anything would have happened differently, if former moderator Aquila would have been able to represent these men at the trial before the session.
Well, I'll tell you this, Ryan, I am 100% in favor of that. And, you know, we actually passed an amendment essentially to that effect a few years ago. It passed the presbyteries, and then it was defeated on the floor of GA on its second reading.
Mm.
So I really, really think we need to bring that back. Although here's something to consider, right? If any community member of the PCA can act as counsel, then you're going to have women acting as counsel.
That is something to consider.
So, you know, we got female lawyers in the denomination. Yeah. So what's going to happen when one of them turns up to represent somebody before a court of the church?
And, you know, I could see that as being a benefit. I could see that even maybe being a unifying, you know, if guys like you and me are in favor of that, of the principle, at least of any community member. You know, it could also be limited to any officer of the PCA. I know I've seen one proposal that might do that. Whether it would make it through the presbyteries again is another issue. Some of the arguments that Presbytery made, I thought were especially memorable, particularly their assessment that the Jonesboro men needed to do more at trial than plead not guilty and then cross-examine the witnesses. What do you make of the Presbytery's argument there that they didn't do enough to establish their lack of guilt? Was that just a misunderstanding by one of the Presbytery's respondents? Or is there a theory of jurisprudence that I'm just unaware of?
Oh, well, I mean, look, there have certainly been courts throughout the history of the world where they put the burden on the accused to prove you're not guilty. But
that's outside of Star Chamber or the Soviet Union.
I thought that was fairly amazing. As I alluded to earlier, it amounts to this sort of burden shifting, right, where we've made this nameless, faceless indictment against you that says, you know, you violated the Fifth and Ninth Commandments, and I'll prove you didn't, and we're not going to tell you when you did. That's just unjust.
Yeah, it was sometime between, you know, around August 3rd all the way to August 30th, sometime around there you did this. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, you know, let's say you are counsel for the defense here. And you know, what strategies, what would you advise them to deploy in a trial where they don't know what they're accused of? Or is this the only option that they have, is to cross-examine and plead not guilty?
Well, I mean, I'm known in my law practice for being ridiculously aggressive. So I love to bring collateral lawsuits. I love to bring counterclaims. I love to use discovery as a way to make the other side's life miserable. You know, everything within biblical morality and the rules of ethics and the law, I'm going to do whatever I can to advance my client's position, right? And so here, I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know all the facts. It sounds like they were fairly well represented, and that they kept raising the deficiency of the indictments over and over again. You might have summoned some additional witnesses. That might have been a way to cast some light onto the proceeding, right? Is insist on some other people, maybe some other members of the congregation, drag every single member of the congregation into the trial by summons and put them on one at a time. Wasn't that big a congregation?
Yeah.
Bring in, you know, the pastor in question that was in controversy. Put him on the stand, put his wife on the stand, put his friends from seminary on the stand, you know, start getting various members of the presbytery. Yeah. Just, you know, amp it up. Right. And really lean in and make the other side work for it and, you know, see what you can do to work with it. But ultimately here, I mean, that's all just around the edges.
Right. Right.
This was, you know, they weren't told what they were accused of. And then there's this decision say, oh, yep, violated the Fifth and Ninth Commandment. It was just such a fundamentally broken and unjust process that I don't know that any representation would have made it come out differently.
Yeah, I don't know. And to your point, you know, you could have probably 7 billion witnesses for these men who did not see them violate the Fifth and Ninth Commandment. So, you know, they could have had a almost endless list of witnesses who didn't see them violate those commandments. But you know, what else can you do when they've been pleading for specificity? So Presbytery argued that the Jonesboro 7 and subsequently the SJC didn't give attention to the spiritual aspect of discipline. Do you think there's a false dichotomy between the spiritual aspect of discipline and the procedural aspect to it? How would you, or is that something that we can hold in balance or tension?
Well, I think you know what I'm going to say, of course, but
of course.
No, I mean, there is no dichotomy between the two. You don't do the spiritual without following the procedure.
Right.
And when I read that in the brief and some of your prior comments on it, is what it sets up is this idea that because I claim to be acting spiritually, I can ignore the BCO, I can ignore the process and just do whatever I want, you know, because I claim that I'm acting for your spiritual good. So you know what, Ryan, I personally am not joining a church where I give the session that kind of power over me, that they can inflict censures, they can suspend me from the Lord's table, they can kick me out of the church as long as they say they're acting spiritually, but not have to follow the rules. No. That is itself a sin in my book.
Mm. One of the things Paul Harrell said is, you know, they joined the PCA because of the goalposts and the guardrails, that this is a place where my family will be safe because it's not, you know, just congregational chaos. It's Presbyterianism where you have systems of courts, you have oversight, you have review and control. And that's a good analogy that you put it, that, well, we're doing this for spiritual purposes. I've heard people say things along the lines of, well, we follow the Book of Church Order except where the Bible differs. And, you know, not related to this case, of course, but just, well, no, the Book of Church Order is our accepted interpretation of Scripture.
Now, so, if you think the Book of Church Order conflicts with the Bible, that's something you need to raise. Right?
in an overture.
Absolutely. Perhaps. And more importantly, when you became a church officer, you swore an oath that you would abide by the BCO. So if you thought the BCO conflicted with the Scriptures, you should have raised that then.
Yes. I know in my presbytery, they ask every candidate for licentiate as well as ministers, do you have any scruples with the Book of Church Order? And, you know, most of the time they're no, or, you know, I don't like assistant pastors or something like that, but you have to follow it. We don't have the option of not following the Book of Church Order. So what do you make of this argument about deference? And of course, BCO 39 requires appeals courts to give deference to courts of original jurisdiction. How is that rightly applied?
Well, I could almost just say nothing and say read Jim Eggert's excellent concurrence. But he did a fabulous job of laying this out better than I'm going to be able to on this podcast. But the thing to consider, right, is that, and this happens in civil courts too, they have different standards for different kinds of issues on appeal. And so when you're talking about facts, and particularly how much weight to give to testimony, right? So let's say we have a trial where we have two witnesses who gave conflicting testimony. One says the light was red, one says the light was green. Well, an appellate court is not going to typically disturb the trial court's conclusion as to who to believe, because the trial court, the judge or jury, got to observe those witnesses and watch them testify, and therefore draw conclusions about the veracity and weight of their testimony. And that's something that the appellate court, who has only a cold record, you know, a transcript, can't really do.
Yes.
So typically an appellate court, if finds there's been error, is going to maybe send it back for a new trial, but they're not going to reweigh which witness to believe because they just don't have the resources. They don't have it in front of them. And so that, in my view, is the proper kind of deference that an appellate court should show when it comes to weighing testimony and those kind of factual conclusions, because they just don't have it in front of them. Right now, they may have documentary evidence, or might be emails or text messages or something like that. They might have those, but that's when we talk about deference. That's the kind of deference I think that we're talking about, right? When you're talking about a procedural error or an issue of law, or, you know, was this indictment essentially defective as a matter of law? That's the question here. Then I don't think any deference is appropriate in that situation. I think that's what a lawyer would call de novo review, right? You just look at it fresh. And another point I thought that Jim made in his concurrence that was really excellent was that the presbytery and the SJC are similarly situated in terms of their review. The SJC owes no deference to Presbytery here to the extent Presbytery was itself an appellate court, because the Presbytery didn't have any additional information that the SJC didn't have. It wasn't like the Presbytery heard the witnesses, right? The trial was before the session. So if the Presbytery had been the court of original jurisdiction, that'd be a different story. But that wasn't the case here. So I thought that was a good point that I hadn't previously considered.
Yeah. And then the importance of the record of the case and sticking just to what's in the record. I think, you know, one of the things that was mentioned that from the trial was, well, you know, you can look at somebody and, or, you know, what's his expression, and you can make a decision based on that that's not in the record, or you know of things that are going on in the congregation. But those, if it's not in the record, how is that weighed as evidence? Should is that what, you know, watching JAG or, you know, growing up, let the record show the witness pointed to, you know, the defendant or whatnot, because you can't.
No, I mean, if you're sitting as a judge in a church court, you may not consider anything that's not put before you as evidence, period. You know, in the case of an appellate court, it's based on the record of the case. In the case of a trial court, it's the evidence that's put before you, whether it's in writing or in person. But you may not. You are in error. You are violating your oath if you consider anything that's outside the evidence put on in the case. I view that as grave.
So when, you know, when a judge would or a witness or would allude to something not within the record, there's just no basis for that in our polity.
Well, no, if a witness says it, then the witness is putting it in the record.
Okay.
Right? The witness is testifying. So whatever the witness has said, that's the record. That's evidence, right? Unless it's struck or excluded.
Yeah. But, okay. Yeah.
But if on appeal,
yes.
You know, like say in the scenario we had here, where there's an intermediate appeal before the Presbytery, if the Presbytery's commission injects facts into the case that weren't in the record, that would be serious error.
Yes.
Now, of course, our appellate courts do have the ability to expand the record, and we've seen that fairly prominently in the last few years for the SJC, where the commission decided to reopen the record and add new material, and the OMSJC does allow that. And so if the proper procedure is followed, then that doesn't violate the rules.
I see. So a judge is, you know, at a local, and that's one of my concerns. I've thought about this in my own context, that if I have a member of the congregation I serve, and I have to sit in judgment on her, you know, she's been investigated, indicted, comes to trial. How do I put aside my personal feelings and confine it just to the record of the case? That's so difficult. And I wonder, and I guess that's why our book provides a revision that you can have a session trial move to the Presbytery if the session believes there's sufficient warrant for it. It's just hard, right? It's hard.
No, it is. And it's one of the peculiarities of a church trial, you know, because it is ultimately the session that's doing the trying. And, you know, if like me, you're in a relatively small church, everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
This is not a situation where there's a civil judge where you show up and it's a civil judge says, oh, I know the defendant, and he'll recuse himself and get another judge. We don't have that option. Right. So if the session's going to try it, yeah, people are going to know stuff. They're going to have knowledge of the facts. You know, what the BCO precludes is not having prior knowledge of the facts, but having to express an opinion on the outcome of the case. That disqualifies you. But I don't think practically we could say, but what you've got to do is, you know, and you're going to promise to do so, to set aside everything else you know and judge purely based on the evidence before you. And if you can't do it, you got to recuse yourself.
Yeah. All right, let me ask you about that. The give an opinion on the outcome of the case. When, you know, Session sent them a letter, and this was in the record of the case, you know, saying you need to repent, you're on a path that leads to death and shale or something like that. You know, that sounds pastoral, but they're in the middle of judicial process. So how do you balance those concerns? You know, the session obviously had concerns for the souls of these men, warning them about, you know, a path that leads to shale and destruction or something of that sort. But also having to come unbiased as judges.
Well, look, we have joint and several duties as elders.
Yeah.
We do that, which is ministerial and declarative.
Right.
And there's both that pastoral role and then there's the judicial role. And you just got to do them both.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying this is easy, but it's just the way our polity is constructed.
As that was one of the things I heard was that, you know, even after the representative of the Jonesboro 7, former moderator Aquila's time was up, one of the SJC judges brought up that letter and said, hey, you know, you mentioned in your brief, you know, there were so many things that, you know, what is it, you got a half hour to present your case at the SJC, and then there's questions in addition to that. But I think moderator Aquila had run out of time, and then one of the judges brings up, you didn't mention this, but do you think that was an instance of bias against the accused? And so even the SJC judges, they just looked over this case with such a fine eye that they found things that weren't even brought up by the defense team. You know, you mentioned the concurrence by Elder Eggert. He said, it's not the session's place to effectively make its own support of the organizing minister grounds for process, discipline, and censure against any members of the congregation who hold a different opinion. So in your reading of this, it was simply a difference of opinion that got these guys, these seven men, into trouble. What else, you know, stood out to you in the Eggert concurrence?
Well, again, I thought the whole thing was fabulous, but he really made a good point here, because it seemed like this is what's happening, is the provisional session, they're on a mission. They've got a plan, right? They're trying to get this church particularized. They want to get the organizing pastor installed as the pastor of the new church. And they seem unhappy that a significant amount of the congregation disagrees with that plan. And, I don't want to money quarterback the whole thing, but it certainly seems like it would have been a reasonable choice at that point, and a wise choice, to take a step back and say, okay, we've got, you know, a big chunk of the congregation here, you know, something approaching half, that's, you know, pretty strongly opposed to this. Maybe we should stop and rethink it. You know, if you look at the provisions in the BCO about the election of officers, whether it's a pastor or a ruling elder or a deacon, you know, if you have a substantial minority, you're supposed to go back and ask the majority to desist, mm-hmm. and not elect the man over the objection of this plurality. And it seems that principle should have been animating here. And to turn around, and I think Jim says it well here, to, you know, use the power of the session and this, you know, judicial process to essentially quash dissent, I think it was wrong. And in particular, this is not a situation where this is something within the province of the session to do. You know, if this was an organized church and the session is making a decision which is purely the session's power, you know, they're deciding the budget, or they're calling an assistant pastor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's something that is within their power to do, and the congregation, they can express their opinion on it, but they have no power one way or another to affect that decision, at least in terms of voting, right? But when it comes to calling a pastor at a newly organized church, that is a power given to the congregation. So the idea that the session could use the threat, or in this case, the actuality of judicial process and sanction to stifle dissent, I find troubling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought Jim put it well here. And then he goes on in this next paragraph. In the case of a mission church, it is not the personal franchise of the organizing minister to continue to labor amongst his planted congregation if, at the time of particularization, the congregation elects not to call him, nor is it the franchise of the temporary session of a mission church to see him installed, no matter how enthusiastically it may support him.
Hmm.
And, you know, I suspect we'll see this situation again sometime. Think about, you know, I've been involved in a couple of church plants, and it's a huge deal. Right. To some extent, you know, for a guy to come in as a teaching elder and, you know, start a plan, particularly if he doesn't have an established group of ruling elders that he's working with, you know, feels like starting a small business. You know, it's like you're pouring body and soul, you and your wife and everybody, you know, we're putting everything you can into this church plant for a period of years, in this case, 4 years. And with the expectation that you're building something is going to become a permanent job for you. You know, and that you're going to continue to build and shepherd this congregation, and you feel like it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, to have that thwarted, and to see the church that you started go in another direction and not want to call you, that's a very, very hard thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Very, very hard thing. But we've got some procedural protections in place here, because at the end of the day, it's not your church, Mr. Right. Organizing Pastor. It's Christ's church. And it's, you know, it's the congregation's church, the people who are the church.
Who are members of it. Yeah.
Right. It's their church. And so ultimately the power to choose that pastor and in Presbyterianism is, it's according to the congregation.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the feedback I've received in the articles is people have, you know, said, this is more Episcopalian. This is Anglican. If they wanted that, there's a place for them. But, this is part of the wharf and woof, you know, one of the fundamental preliminary principles of our denomination, and not even just ours, but Presbyterianism in the Western Hemisphere was violated here. Well, as we kind of wrap up, what excites you about the PCA in our current time? What do you desire for the PCA? Maybe what concerns do you have as an elder in the PCA?
All right. I'll see if I can take those three in order. What excites me? The thing that excites me the most is that I see a rising generation of elders who are younger than me, who are deeply committed to being Reformed and Presbyterian. I think, you know, and I was 5 years ago, I thought the PCA was done. Hmm. I was, you know, talking with other guys on my session in our presbytery about, gosh, what are we going to do? Is there going to be a schism? Or are we going to have a you know, confessional departure from the PCA? And the Lord has just been faithful. He's turned it around. And I, you know, from where I sit right now, I think we're maybe more Reformed and more Presbyterian than we've been in 50 years. I see it's people younger than me that are driving that and pushing that and making that happen. And I find that really exciting and deeply encouraging. And I'm glad to be around in the church at this time in history.
Yeah. It seems like the seeds planted by those first generations are bearing really abundant fruit now. In a few weeks, I'll have an episode with some of our founding fathers, and you know, these are guys who are no differences on the standards, and you know, they were the ones teaching in the seminaries, and now to see 50 years later, the men that they taught are becoming elders, are becoming teaching elders, and the denomination is more healthy now, and more committed to the Westminster standards than she was 50 years ago. And I think Palmer Robertson made that point on George Sayor's podcast, that our standards were being pulled toward our standards, which is a remarkable work of God's Spirit. So, yeah, I'm excited about that as well. What do you desire for the PCA going forward?
That we remain faithful.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like, and I got a little preview of this when I moved to New York City in 1998, and now it's swept the rest of the country, and that is cultural Christianity is gone. Hmm. Right. We're now, you know, a couple generations behind a place. If you think about post-war America in the 50s, when going to church was cool. Right. There was lots of cultural Christianity. Like if you didn't go to church, there was something wrong with you. Right. If you're any respectable person went to church, and there were lots of buildings that had church on the outside, whether they preached the gospel or not, because everybody went to church. There was this massive cultural Christianity. Big endowments were built up. You see these mainline denominations that had these massive endowments, all this money, because it was all built up during that time, right? And so, but you know what? That's gone.
Yeah.
There's nothing cool about being a Christian anymore. It doesn't get you any social cachet. It doesn't get you any professional cachet, right? It's very much the opposite, right? And so I think with that, right, as the chaff is burned away, right? What, and the sheep are separated from the goats. I think it gives us a more pure and more faithful church. Right. And I just continue to pray and labor to the extent that I can to keep us faithful to the scriptures. Right. When we are under this massive cultural pressure to do anything but. And so I think it's in some ways it's what's making the church healthy, because people who don't believe the Bible is true aren't coming to our churches, because why would they?
Right.
You know, I say all the time, there's a nice brunch place around the corner from our church building, called Can Can. It's a French place. It's amazing. And I say, look, if I didn't believe the Bible was true, I would not be standing here this morning. I would be over there having a nice cup of coffee and a brunch and reading my New York Times. Mm. Because that's the dichotomy we have, right? The only reason that I am here at 9:30 on Sunday morning is because I believe the Bible is true.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned your church building. Tell me, you're a relatively young congregation, but you have an historic building. Is that right at All Saints?
It is true. So, we're not that young. We were founded in 1984. We were planted by Stony Point Reformed Presbyterian Church in 84. And you mentioned Dan Carroll earlier. Dan's a ruling elder at Stony Point. Stony Point, and also the aforementioned Dominic Aquila is also the former pastor of Stony Point.
So there's, I thought that sounded familiar.
Connections there. And Stony Point was an RPCES congregation that came in the joining and receiving. And then they were sort of working on planning us about that time. So the full name of our church is All Saints Reformed Presbyterian Church. That's sort of keeping the moniker from the RPCES, although we were never an RPCES congregation. And the received lore from the folks that were there in 1984 is that they're riding around this neighborhood. It's now referred to as the Museum District because our building is right behind the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. It was a dubious neighborhood in 1984, and they're riding around looking for a place to meet. They knock on the door of this church, and it's sort of an unaffiliated church, and say, "Hey, would y'all consider letting us rent your building on Sunday nights, so we can start meeting?" And the church administrator or secretary who answers the door said, "Well, how did you know that we voted last night to sell our building?" And the church was, in fact, winding down and looking to sell their building, and so the building was purchased for a relatively modest sum, like a couple $100,000, which at the time was like, blood, sweat, and tears to try to get the mortgage and get paid off. But it's now worth, many multiples of that as the neighborhood has come up and inflation has changed money too. So from the very beginning, the church was able, through the Lord's providence, was able to get this building. And, the building was built in 1922, so not all that historic in Virginia terms, but still not new. And it's a, it's the only church I've ever belonged to that had a paid off building. That one had a building. I've been to some that didn't have a building. I've been to some that had buildings with mortgages, but I've never been to one that had a paid off building before. So that's a tremendous blessing that gives us a lot of flexibility in terms of our finances.
Absolutely.
Right? We can put more money into ministry instead of putting it into, building programs all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Pay it. You can put it forward. Yeah. So, what concerns do you have about the PCA in the next 50 years?
I don't think it's really any different than what I just said. I think that we remain faithful, right? To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, we're never more than one generation away, right? So we've got to catechize our children. We've got to raise them. We've got to train them in the Christian worldview. One of the things that I spend a ton of time on at teaching is apologetics and Christian worldview, right? I'm a fairly committed Bantillian. I spend a lot of time talking to our high school kids and our adults about how to rightly divide, right? You're going to encounter these people in the world that do not have cohesive worldviews. They've got very strong opinions on ethics and morality, but there's no basis for that whatsoever other than zeitgeist, right? So I want to try to encourage people to think deeply, to ground their worldview, to ground their thinking in the Word of God, right? The one true thing, the philosopher's stone, if you take philosophy classes in college, we've already got it, right? It's the Word of God. The Bible is true. That's your first premise. That's your basic presupposition. And you've got to just violently hold on to that and measure everything you encounter by it, or you're lost in this culture. So what am I concerned about is that we're not doing that enough. That we need to train and catechize every single one of our people, every single one of our covenant children, to be ready to face that, Marxist professor when they get to college.
Yeah, it goes back to Deuteronomy 6. We never get beyond home discipleship. Well, thank you very much for your time. This was insightful for me. Appreciate your work with the church and your ministry locally and at the General Assembly.
Well, thanks so much for the work that you're doing and for doing this this excellent podcast. I'm always encouraged when I get your Substack articles that come out and try to listen to your podcast when I can too. And just the tremendous work you're doing is a great benefit to the church and to our denomination.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. I hope you and your family have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review in the app of your choice. And I would be grateful if you shared this episode on your social media. Please come back again next week for another lecture from the 2023 Reformation and Worship Conference as Dr. Robert Godfrey explains the seismic shift that took place over the 20th century in the worship of American churches. By understanding what has happened in the worship dysfunction of our current day, we can better find our way back to the historic principles of Reformed and biblical worship.